It's The Wonky Show. It's been a big week for regulation in England with a temporary closure of the register. We'll be discussing the fallout and implications. International students are back in the spotlight thanks to a Radio 4 documentary and significant changes to fees and maintenance in Wales. It's all coming up.
If you're a student and you are working for the university, say, you will be paid the real living wage. But when you're studying, you're not being supported on the real living wage, which is another inequity that this introduces.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly end to this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to pull at the threads of a week of HE policy, we have three fantastic guests. In commentary, it's Becky Freeman, Deputy Pro Vice Chancellor for Education at the University of Warwick. Becky, your highlights of the week, please.
So we're at the end of a really busy first term here at Warwick, and there's been an awful lot packed into this week. I'm really lucky to be based right at the centre of our campus and near some student music practice rooms. So the last couple of weeks of real busyness, I've had the lovely sounds of a range of Christmas choirs and bands practicing their Christmas repertoires and the Christmas light switch on, which just has given it a lovely feeling to the end of term.
In Cambridge is Jonathan Grant, Director at Different Angles. Jonathan, your heart of the week, please.
Well, I'm going to cheat a bit, Mark, because I'm looking out of my window into another wet, grey day. I've been really busy this week, but on Saturday I'm going with my daughter to Essaouira in Morocco for 4 nights, so I'm very much looking forward to that.
Interesting. And nice weather?
Hopefully. No, better be.
In less nice weather in Wandsworth, it's Livia Scott, Monkey's Part Show coordinator. Livia, your highlight of the week, please.
My highlight of the week is probably a bit more dismal, but I didn't have to have a wisdom tooth removed this week, so woo! That's definitely a highlight.
Well, there's always next week. So, we start the week with the closing of the register. Livia, what on earth is going on?
So, the Office for Students have announced a temporary closure of any providers entering the register, and this is an aim to free up precious resources that will allow, in theory, the Office for Students to focus on financial sustainability. And it's come in with mixed reviews from the sector, which I'm sure we'll get into. But the closure comes into effect now and will affect live and planned future applications for registration, degree award and powers, and for university title changes. So no more name change headlines in the Wonky Daily anymore. All the requests currently in the system have now been paused until August 2025. So basically until the start of the next academic year. And what this means is that no provider can join or change their status on the register. So this puts providers who were maybe planning to join the register or were kind of reviewing their plans, they're not currently able to kind of continue with those. And, you know, some of those providers might have had intensive marketing strategies ready to go. And it feels like it's putting them potentially at a bit of a disadvantage to plan for the year ahead, particularly if those kind of award and powers are not going to come into play again. The register's not going to be unpaused until August 2025. But OFS have assured providers that these are very much temporary restrictions, and they have said that these are positive steps so that they can work more closely with institutions under significant financial pressure and in order to protect the interests of students. It's gone down with mixed reviews, shall we say, but yeah, that's kind of what's happened at the moment.
So yeah, I mean, this is going to be felt differently across the different parts of the sector, isn't it, Jonathan? Because obviously if you're on the register already, then you're not going to care so much, but you might be worried about what this points to in terms of where regulation is heading.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, sort of verges on being a scandal in its own right. It feels like the regulator is failing to fulfill their duties. If you're going to close the registration and then backdate it to people in the system, I think that from a process point of view is sort of pretty unacceptable. I imagine any institution that's gone through all the effort to file all the paperwork and then they're told it's not going to be considered for the next X months. If I was in that situation, I'd be pretty upset. And it also kind of says that OFS is, you know, sort of, let's say, overstretched rather than broken. And there needs to be some fundamental thinking about what's its purpose, because at the moment it's clear it can't fulfill some of its core duties, of which I'd put registration in them. So I think this, you know, this sounds quite technocratic, but I think it sort of signals a bunch of stuff that is actually quite worrying.
Mm. Yeah, I think for me, it feels a little bit like the, you know, if you were a teacher in a class and it feels a little bit like like the loudest kids in the class are kind of getting all the attention, so that the people who are already on the kind of register, we're focusing on generally larger institutions that may be experiencing significant financial pressure. And I think the frustration from other folks in the sector, so we've had IHE and Guild HE kind of come out quite strongly against this, against pauses. And the frustration is that these people who have kind of put applications in haven't just put them in the past kind of week or so. There are some that have been in there for nearly a year and kind of haven't been responded to, haven't been backdated. And I think the frustration is that, you know, it's putting pauses on providers who kind of, they can't do anything now until, well, they can still do things, but they kind of, the progress and all the work that has gone into multiple rounds of applications, multiple bits of work, kind of that apparently the feedback from OFS on getting onto the register has been very mixed. And it's kind of calls into question, I guess, is the degree award and powers that OFS were awarded, you know, when the QA was no longer made the designated quality body, is the OFS fit or at least able to do these things in a timely manner, which I think the whole sector is feeling like that does not seem true at the moment.
Mm. And how does this look, Becky, from, you know, you work at a university that is very firmly on the register, but how does that look from your perspective?
I mean, I can see the rationale behind it. So obviously there are huge major changes and transitions due to the financial situation that the OFS are dealing with at the moment. So that rationale rings true. It's a good one, but I think it has really drawn my attention to, through kind of reading about the experiences of those smaller providers going through these processes, the timescales and level of work and kind of frustration with that process, and the challenges there, which I think it, you know, really kind of opened my eyes to some of that. I can see as well how frustrating that must be for those providers mid process, and that connection to the financial support available to students as well, I think is really real. This is where those institutions are heading, and so having that paused and a focus taken away from providers is a real problem.
I do like Ian Mansfield's I was going to say tweet. I don't know what we describe posts on Blue Sky anymore. I don't often find myself agreeing with Ian, but I think he's got a point. Is this a prelude to some more fundamental change that people are thinking about? That may be the case, but then let's be transparent about that.
That's interesting. Yeah. So looking at the you know, how much in the tea leaves can we discern about, you know, what the approach to regulation will be in the future from all this. Joe Johnson, his former boss, also very unhappy about that for similar reasons. He said, a big fan of RFS, but this is an exceptionally poor decision. We need to embrace high quality new providers, not shut up shop and close the door to innovation and choice. James Coe from this parish, also similarly very critical. But Jackie Smith, Minister for all of this, talking about this earlier this week, it's quite interesting to listen to. Let's hit the clip.
This week saw the most extraordinary announcement from the Office for Students that it was suspending its activity in relation to new registrations, new applications for degree awarding powers, and new applications for university title until at least August 2025 to allow it to focus on the financial sustainability of the sector. And I just wondered, does the Minister agree with me that this sends the most terrible message to students both in this country and overseas and risks undermining the financial sustainability it seeks to achieve?
No, I don't agree with the noble lady. In fact, the message that it sends is that this government, unlike the last, is determined to ensure that we put universities on a firmer financial footing. We're not willing to sit by, as the last government did, whilst universities face considerable financial pressure.
And so, obviously, framing it as a thing about finances, but I wonder, Jonathan, could this be a straw in the wind for a more planned, kind of less marketized system of regulation?
Well, yeah, I mean, it could be. It's very hard to read. I mean, there seems to me that there are sort of three scenarios here from the OFS point of view. One, we take it at face value, and basically what they're saying is they don't have enough qualified staff to do this work and they need to redeploy them on financial sustainability. If that is a case, that's a failure of OFS's leadership and management in having enough people to do what they're required to do. The second one is that this is a political decision that is a prelude to some further, probably tightening of the market, deliberalisation of the market. And the third one is this is just a cock-up and people haven't realised, especially about the freezing of existing applications, registrations, what that means. But Mark, I was also thinking, if this was Ofwat, and Ofwat came out and said, we're not going to undertake any further regulatory duty in this area because this water company building's just about to go bust and we got to put all our attention on that, this would be headline news. It would be, you know, unacceptable.
Well, I guess there's a problem at RFS in that what it needs to be doing now is different to what it was imagined they would be doing when it was set up, and it's taken a long time to catch up with, and it's causing all these sorts of problems.
I mean, I think it's funny, isn't it? Like, as a sector, all we've been talking about over the past few months is we want the government and we want OFS to kind of recognize the, you know, the financial challenges that are happening in the sector. And it's like part of us, or part of my brain at least, was like, well, at least they're doing that. But I guess the way in which that they're doing it is it feels frustrating. It feels like it's going to do, you know, more damage than good in some places. And like Jonathan said, it feels like, is this partly, you know, if we're taking it at face value, is this partly because OFS just doesn't kind of have the qualified staff at the moment to kind of, or the resource to fully focus on financial sustainability and also look at, I think there's like 15 or 21 different applications that are kind of currently in the system and they can't do both, which feels very frustrating if they're kind of, their job as a regulator is to do both, like that they should be doing both at the same time. And I think there's a frustration, I guess, that finally we've got a government and we've got, you know, a regulator acknowledging the financial challenge in the sector, but the way in which that is the way in which they're doing that, at least to me, feels like it is going to be potentially damaging, and it's just not the way that we'd want them to do it. Like, I feel like I'm explaining that in a poor way, but they're just doing it in a really frustrating way. It just feels a bit too little too late.
Yeah, it needs to be a regulator for all providers. That's its role. And so doing that consistently seems pretty fundamental.
Let's see who's been blocking for us this week.
Hi, I'm Dr. Alexander Bradley, and together with my colleague, Dr. Martin Quigley, this week on Wonky, we've been blogging about representation ratios and the awarding gap. Now, representation ratios can be valuable in allowing us to take account of base rate information and looking at our data from a different perspective. Let's imagine an example. 60% of black students get good degrees, 74% of white students get good degrees. So the awarding gap is 14%. We now learn the proportion of good degrees is 72%. So we can calculate the awarding representation gap by dividing 60% by 72%, and that gets 0.83, meaning black students are actually underrepresented in good degrees by 17%, and white students are overrepresented by 2%, 74 divided by 72. Using HESA data from the last 9 years, we showed the awarding gap between black and white students in good degrees has been between 18 to 24%, yet the representation ratio shows black students are consistently underrepresented by between 19 to 28%. Representation ratios can be another valuable way of looking at data. By taking account of base information, you could develop fresh insights. Learn more at this week's blog.
Now, Farlon 4 on BBC's Radio 4 has an expose on international students. Jonathan, walk us through it.
Yeah, this is a 40-minute broadcast on Radio 4 with the sort of tabloid title, The International Student Scandal. It is framed as a story about international students having very weak English and academic skills. But when you listen to the full 40 minutes, it's actually a very good analysis as to why the current financial framework for universities in England is broken. The programme begins and ends with an interview with an Iranian student who recounts her experiences on a master's programme with a cohort of students who were largely unable to speak or understand English in lectures. And this was reinforced by an unnamed academic who claimed that the majority of students in his seminars could not speak English sufficiently well to participate. And he also made the accusations of widespread cheating via both essay meals and AI. Irrespective of whether you believe these two anecdotes, Rose Stevenson from HEPI does a great job in explaining how the situation has come about, that is, the need for international student income to cost subsidized both research and increasingly domestic fees. And to be fair, the presenter, Paul Kenyon, is very sympathetic to this argument. Nevertheless, for those who don't listen to the full episode or rely on the article on the BBC website, you will be left with a negative view of the way universities operate, and that will further tarnish the sector's reputation, especially with those who listen to BBC Radio 4. So in short, the episode covers a range of issues familiar to listeners of Wonky Show: university finance, international students, student migration, essay meals, use of agents and such like, and is further evidence of how broken the system currently is in the UK.
Right, yeah, and I think we've got a clip. This is Vivian Stern from UK being interrogated about this.
We've spoken to a lot of people who say there are people on their courses who don't really speak any English at all.
I refute that. This system is designed to require universities to demonstrate that students have appropriate levels of English language.
That just doesn't doesn't match what the situation on the ground is that we've had reported from multiple professors and academics all across the UK. The professor from the Russell Group University says, and I'm going to quote him, he says that the clear majority of seminar groups that I have taught do not have the requisite language skills to be able to manage.
In order to be able to recruit international students, universities have to be able to meet expectations that are set by the government, by the Home Office.
There are compulsory English tests to qualify for a student visa, but students have told us that officials are bribeable in some of their countries of origin.
So lots in here that wouldn't be particularly new to people working in the sector, but I've been in lots of discussions about this over the last couple of days, and lots of complaints about, well, you know, there's no kind of gotcha, you know, element to this. Like, well, this is kind of, you know, this is a business as usual. But isn't the problem that is a much bigger problem in that this, you know, this is the sort of thing is listened to by influential people, and it piles pressure on the government ultimately over international students. Whether or, you know, we can kind of quibble with the meat of it, as you know, as a sector did, you know, substantially with that Sunday Times expose earlier in the year. But ultimately, it doesn't really get you anywhere, because it's the impact these things have on the kind of commentariats, on politicians, etc. When they go out. So that's my theory. Becky, I'll get your take on this. It's just that this is unhelpful for the mood music, because it pushes pressure on government rather than sheds any extra new light or anything.
I think that's right. I think one of the things that I really noted was it's part of the nature of documentary making, but the stuff that's really missing was missing from that the documentary and the article. And as Universities UK say, universities do an awful lot of work to uphold quality and standards, and ensuring that quality interest is absolutely fundamental, and having those processes in place that are backed up by the government is fundamental. So that is really, really important. But there is so much that having international students brings to the university system that just really didn't really get a look in terms of that global community, that the kind of the wealth of experience, diversity, different viewpoints that just felt like it was really lacking from that documentary. I think what it also did was focus very much on that entry point, which of course was you know what they were thinking about, but thinking also about all of the other stuff that matters in this space. And we know that students arrive and they have the levels of English required to engage, but we also know that learning in a second language is challenging, and then the academic writing and engagement skills have to be fundamental to our courses too. So I think all of the stuff that universities do to set up classrooms that enable engagement of all of our students that have changed over the last 30 years to ensure that the learning, the teaching, the assessment is all kind of fundamentally set up in order to develop that engagement and of all of our students, I think was just lacking really.
Well, I don't think many people would disagree with that, Becky. I mean, Livia, there is, you know, help us find the kind of kernel of truth, you know, in the criticism about particularly the language issue, because there are some legitimate concerns, aren't there, that, you know, it's a bit uncomfortable for the sector.
Yeah, and I think thinking back in my previous life in my student union role, is that there are genuine concerns. The amount of student unions I've spoken to where they've kind of voiced this, perhaps not in the terms that is kind of laid out in the article and in the investigation, but in the sense of more thinking about, you know, the transition support, I guess. Because I think for me, when I was looking at this, I was like, well, there's three things. Like, is this a question of minimum standards and the kind of language skills of students when they arrive? Is it a kind of question about agents and the way that agents operate in home countries, for example, and the kind of way that agents are perhaps explaining how you can kind of cheat the system, if we're going to call it that, and kind of do the kind of IELTS test or kind of get someone to do it for you, all of that sort of thing? Or is it, and I think this is what Becky was hinting at, is this all about, you know, transitions and institutions kind of needing to provide better transition support? Because I think there was something about the piece and the kind of quotes given from the student that they spoke to that suggested to me that this is less about language barriers in the sense that students aren't kind of qualifying enough to kind of get onto the course, is that they're able to kind of meet those standards. But then when you arrive in a different country, speaking a kind of second or perhaps third language, and you're learning in a way that is perhaps very different to, for example, if you're a PGT student, if you're learning in a way that is very different to the way that you've always taught, always always been taught or the way that you've always kind of learned at school or a previous degree. I think there's something there around immersion and kind of cultural competencies and about a lesser limited language understanding in terms of getting in, but more limited language understanding in terms of kind of being able to fully immerse yourself and fully participate in your course. And I think I've heard so many tales of institutions who have had, you know, international students who have, for example, if we're thinking about this from a digital perspective, never used Teams before or Blackboard or whatever kind of LLE that people, not LLE, online learning thing that people use. VLE, that's it. There's too many LEs in the sector. Yeah. But, you know, and they have a very different understanding of the purpose of assessment, for instance, or what qualifies as your own work, or, you know, how you're supposed to work to complete your assessment. And I think for me, that was where the kind of conversation around people using contract cheating agencies is coming in, is that perhaps there's more going on to those international students' lives that is perhaps why they may turn to AI or why they may turn to kind of contract cheating sites that, you know, I'm not kind of excusing it, but in the sense of the reasons that they may be doing that is perhaps they may not understand that they can't do that, right? Or they may not understand that that is not what this assessment is about, or they may not understand kind of how to do their assessment well. And then because they don't feel like they're supported, or they don't feel like they're kind of immersed in their course, they don't then feel able to kind of ask for support. And it's kind of a vicious cycle of, I think there's more to it, that again, a 40-minute documentary about, you know, from somebody who's not immersed in the sector isn't going to kind of pick up on. But I think this, for me, felt like a question of belonging, really.
Yeah, but Livia, if I can just come in on that. I mean, all of that I agree with, but you're never going to get that into a 40-minute documentary on Radio 4. You know, so, and Mark said it, this is a communications problem for the sector, because, you know, the title of this, you know, the actual show, the 40 minutes, I thought was a pretty fair assessment of the sort of challenges facing universities and why they are reliant on international students. It could have said a whole lot of other stuff around belonging, around the value of having international students and what have you. But for what it was, it was, in my mind, a reasonably fair assessment. And I think the question we need to be asking ourselves is, why is it that every 6 months somebody feels they can do an expose on universities with the title, you know, scandal in the title, on Radio 4, which, as Mark said, the commentariat listened to, and we're just not getting our message across as a sector. Why is that? Why have we become a sector that, you know, we can be hit at? And actually, there's a much more positive story. And all the detail, the facts in that interview seemed to me reasonably sensible. The one question I had coming away from it is there any evidence on, you know, the number of students who do struggle once they've been accepted into universities around language skills? Because there's lots of anecdote. We get two anecdotes in the documentary. I hear anecdotes all the time. I'm sure you guys do. But actually, it'd be great to see if there's any hard evidence on that.
I was going to talk a bit about how I think there's two responsibilities really that the documentary brings to light, and one of them is around responsibility for us to work really hard, and it's connected to discussions that we're having about generative AI and academic integrity too. The role that universities have in articulating to students in meaningful ways the importance of engagement and why we're asking students to do particular engagements, to do different assessments, to build flexibility, employability. So really, that's about articulating the value of engagement to our students and making that really real for our students. And then more widely, how do we articulate to government, but also to wider society, the value of a global education? You know, fundamentally, without a globally diverse education, we're not going to be able to solve some of those really big pressing global challenges. And the richness of having an international student and staff community is a fantastic thing for universities, the students, the staff, but also for our local communities and the economy. But I think we need to get really, really good at articulating that, and in ways that's meaningful.
Right, Wonky's News editor Michael Salmon has been digesting the Scottish budget, so you don't have to.
So the first thing I want to say about the Scottish budget is that if a fundamentalist pro-statistics party ever seizes power in Holyrood, then those involved in this budget are going to be in trouble. It really is a tough old thing to interpret and get to the bottom of. But, you know, once we've finished digging around, it looks like in headline terms, Scottish universities wanted a decent increase to the HE resource budget, and this hasn't materialised. You know, especially when you take inflation into account, it looks like more like a 0.7% cut in real terms. But yeah, there's still more to be worked out. The unit of resource, the spend per student, could rise by 3.5%, but it does depend a little on the exact guidance that the Scottish government gives on how the money should be spent. One thing is for certain, it's certainly not going to offset the increased national insurance contributions that Scottish universities face, and it's also not addressing the longer term slide in Scottish HE funding. And from the student side, on the face of it, it looks like maintenance has been frozen at the same level as in the current academic year, which, if that does prove to be the case, is pretty terrible.
Now, every week this season, we'll be having a think about how things were and how things came to be with Sidi St George's Academic Registrar Mike Ratcliffe, his A Hidden History of Higher Education.
The end of the binary line, the divide between the autonomous sector of universities and the public sector of higher education institutions, comes in two chunks, one at the end of the 80s and one at the beginning of the 90s. The first part is that Margaret Thatcher is persuaded that the polytechnics should be incorporated, i.e. they should be taken out of local authority control. So one of the complaints all the way from the start of the process from polytechnic directors is that they are trapped in a layer of bureaucracy driven by the local authorities. To start with, there were discussions about how much money a polytechnic could spend on its own. Is it £100 or is it £200 without having to go and get the local authorities' control? So they're seen as a department of the local authority. And that heritage continues. So the local government pension scheme that is provided to staff in post-92 institutions is part of that heritage. But at the point, you would find that the paywall was run through them, the committee structure was run through them, they weren't allowed to own their own buildings, everything had to be signed off by the local authority. So Mrs. Thatcher is convinced, and she's convinced again because polytechnics are business focused, they're keen to expand, they're keen to do what the government wants to do. But they also have the extra argument about the loony left, because if there was something that we all know about the way that the Conservative government in the 80s was having to deal with things, they were so against the loony left running large conurbations, and therefore all the polytechnic directors had to say is, we could be so much better if we weren't enthralled to all these people and their anti-nuclear campaigning and all of these kind of things. Just free us from this and we will do all of these kind of things. Whether they believe this or not, it was a really good reason to get Margaret Thatcher behind. So that's fine. And they were incorporated, they were allowed to run free. There's all sorts of weird things that happen apart of that, because obviously some of the polytechnics get dealt quite a good hand. They get to have the countryside training centre that used to belong to the local authority, or they get dealt the hand of the local authority giving them all the really crappy stuff that's going to need huge amounts of maintenance and upgrade. But those kind of things come to a sort of, and the polytechnics get incorporated, and the colleges as well alongside them. There's a discussion about how big you have to be and how much money, and there's a kind of line drawn through the sector as to who gets to be incorporated, and then have its own funding body. So they get looked after by the polytechnics and colleges funding council, and that continues off for a couple of years. But then the next chunk comes after Mrs. Thatcher's left and John Major's come in, and the discussion point comes about the next natural stage, which is, should we have one sector of higher education working together? I think that's probably coloured by the UFC finding it quite hard to make universities do what they're supposed to do, which was to expand cheaply. Polytechnics are quite keen to do that, and the idea of bringing the whole sector together is clearly quite good. There were big concerns in government about academic drift, that sense that polytechnics are going to stop doing what they're good at, and there are documents which read just like the concerns that you'll read in the Telegraph today about polytechnics running two academic courses, doing research that they shouldn't be doing, and generally drifting from their original mission. So there's a concern that they're going to do that. John Major is assured by Ken Clark that though that'll be fine, we'll have lots of mechanisms in place to do that, but off they go and they take the decision that we will have one sector and we'll merge them all together. So polytechnics get the opportunity to become universities, we get HEFC, which then starts its 25-year run, and then we get one sector glued together. Obviously there's lots of discussions when that first comes together. There's a great file again about discussing how the funding model will work and how people will migrate to a single cost. But the sector sets off in a relatively straightforward way. But that initial thing of will there be parity of steam between vocational and academic forms of education? That's a concern that Michael Howard expresses in the paperwork. Is a key tension that I think we're still dealing with today, and one that probably the Conservative Party still fights about. So off we go. This new move towards the classless society, the idea that academic and vocational education would work together, and obviously what we've seen is that development. Now there's an argument, and I think Simon Jenkins that makes it, is that the polytechnics win. Effectively it's the polytechnic model much more than the autonomous model of the universities that win out from that. But that's the sector we get bequeathed in 1992.
Right, finally this week, big changes to fees and maintenance support in Wales. Becky, walk us through it, please.
Okay, so this week the Welsh Government have announced an uplift in undergraduate tuition fees for full-time undergraduate students up to £9,535 from the next academic year, which of course brings Wales in line with the recent fee uplift in England. It's a 3.1% increase, which is intended to provide additional income to Welsh institutions to reflect the increased costs of education and help safeguard provision and investment in the student experience. Undergraduate maintenance support in Wales was previously linked to the living wage, and in this change will now be based on the consumer price index, which means that maintenance support will be going up by just 1.6% in comparison. So the Wonky team have calculated the shortfall in maintenance, and that will mean around a £1,300 difference for full-time students.
This obviously makes the overall package in Wales a lot less generous, although still probably the most generous part of the UK when it comes to maintenance. But it is obviously bad news for students.
Yeah, and as Jim has on the Wonky website, he phrases it, it robs students to pay universities. And I think it's quite sad that they've de-linked from the real living wage, because all Welsh universities pay the real living wage to their employees. So they're also, by doing this, pulling apart, if you like, the student and the staff population in Welsh universities. And I was just checking, and the increase in the real living wage between 2024 and 2025 is about 5%. What I don't understand, I have to say, Mark, is the reason they have used or seem to use around the requirements of the Treasury in Whitehall that is kind of suggests they've been forced into this change. So, as you say, the Welsh system is more generous, and we should hang on to that and congratulate the Welsh government for that. But I think they had set up some really useful principles in linking it to the real living wage. And it's not entirely clear to me why they've made that change. And I think the consequences of that change will directly impact students, obviously, but will undermine that principle and create that inequity between students and staff working in Welsh universities.
Yeah. So it seems that fell foul of a Treasury rule about what you're allowed to do. So clearly a blow also for those campaigning for linking maintenance to a living wage in the rest of the UK.
Well, I was just going to say, of course, the maintenance support is so fundamentally associated with cost of living at the moment, which we know is such a struggle for students and has an impact on engagement, on part-time work, on all kinds of things that and student behaviour. So it's a significant change.
Yeah, but from a university point of view, the fee increase matching England, which was widely expected, but sort of confirms the position, provides that same level of certainty for planning. Although obviously everyone would rather it goes even further. Livia, do you want to comment on this somehow?
Yeah, I think the other part of the puzzle, I guess, particularly around the maintenance stuff, is that, or in terms of a fee increase, is that obviously Wales had this earlier in the year, and it was a little bit messy, if I remember rightly. I remember talking to a lot of our kind of Welsh student unions around how that was going to be kind of implicated at their providers. Was it going to be on kind of current students or just new students? And I think Jim on the site has looked into the kind of competition and market authority guidance, and it feels very unclear, because some university T's and C's say that it's okay to kind of put up fees for current UK undergraduate students because it'll be linked by inflation, for example. example, that will be determined by the Welsh government. But then the Welsh government in this statement hasn't actually mentioned inflation as like the reason for the fee increase. And, you know, the Westminster government is using a different rate of calculation. And I just think it's a little bit messy that, for example, if I was a student now, I mean, look, I wouldn't have detailed knowledge about the terms and conditions of my contract with university. Like, I'll hold my hands up and say that. But I think if I was a student at the moment in Wales, the thing I'd be concerned about is, well, are my fees going to go up like in year if I'm going into my second year? I imagine they will. But I guess there's a kind of question there, as it has been happening in England over the past few months, around contractually, are they able to do that? And I think that question happened in Wales earlier this year, which, you know, might mean it'll be a little bit smoother. But I think that the fact that it's in some terms and conditions, it mentions if it's because of an inflationary increase, that might make this even messier than it was like at the beginning of the year. And I think that's the other part of the fee increase that is just potentially very frustrating for individual providers to basically have to push a bunch of time to sort out, for students themselves to kind of just not know, is it going to go up? Is it not? Is it in theory allowed to go up, or should I be angry about it? Like, do I have a legal kind of rights case to be angry about it? And I think that part of it is just very, very messy when we're looking at this.
Yeah, I just think, can I come in, Mark? I just think the comment Becky made just now got me thinking that, so there's conceptually, if you like, if you're a student and you are working for the university, say, you will be paid the real living wage. But when you're studying, you're not being supported on the real living wage, which is another inequity that this introduces.
I hadn't even thought of that. That's kind of mad. Like, I hadn't even thought of it in that way, that you could potentially, I guess, you know, we said Wales has still got a kind of better package deal than England. But, you know, I do think there's an element of, once you go away from anchoring it to the real living wage, it feels very hard to go back to that. And it feels a lot harder for the kind of, a lot of, you know, the campaigning in England. There's no chance that it's going to be anchored to the real living wage at any point now. Like, if I was in NUS, I'd be fuming, basically, because I'd be like, well, that campaign's out the window, because if they've already reversed it in Wales, the one place where it was kind of, you know, it was happening, it was a kind of, you know, a shining light for a lot of like English providers, there's just no way they're going to kind of, I can't see a world in which they reverse this now and go back to the real living wage anchor.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wokie.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wokie Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on UKHE, do click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Olivia, Becky, Jonathan, and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We're back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wokie.